For many of us, seeing the beauty in other people, being kind and compassionate towards other people, that comes pretty easily. But what's really hard is seeing the beauty in ourselves and being kind and compassionate consistently towards ourselves, especially when difficult things happen. Perhaps someone's critical of us, or we make a mistake. We beat up on ourselves. You could call it the inner critic, or that voice in the head that says mean things. Or you could call it self-hatred. What can we do in these circumstances to interrupt this cycle and learn to befriend ourselves consistently? Sounds True has created the Self-Acceptance Project to investigate this question. We've invited the participation of spiritual teachers, psychologists, neuroscientists, visionary writers, all to look at how can we learn to be kind and compassionate towards ourselves on a consistent basis. Thank you for joining us and welcome. In this episode, I speak with Sharon Salzberg, meditation teacher and co-founder of the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts. Sharon has produced many programs with Sounds True, including the book, The Kindness Handbook, and the audio series, Guided Meditations for Love and Wisdom. Welcome, Sharon.
Thank you.
Now, I know, Sharon, this is a question, this question of how we can be more kind to ourselves. That this is a question you've looked at very, very deeply. And just to begin, I'm curious to know what some of the key observations are that you've made of why people are so chronically hard on themselves.
Well, you know, it may be actually that it's, you know, in part, of course, it's in part personal conditioning, in part it's probably cultural conditioning, because I have that habit and perhaps you have that habit too. Maybe we also generalize it a little bit too much. I don't know that I could make a sweeping statement, you know, that really indicted Western culture in its entirety or something like that. But clearly there's a lot of suffering, and that I think in part it goes back to what maybe in the end, if I'm remembered after I die for any contribution to Buddhism in the West, it probably would be that conversation I had with the Dalai Lama in 1989 or 1990 when I was at a Mind and Life conference in India, a very small private gathering, and I had the chance to ask him a question. And so I said, "Your Holiness, what do you think about self-hatred?" And he said, "What's that?" And it was really fantastic. I was in a room full of psychologists, and there was a philosopher there, and also His Holiness's translators, even the translators from the West. And he was so puzzled, and he said things like, "Is that some kind of nervous disorder? And are people like that very violent?" And we just kept, you know, going back and forth. And at one point he said, "But you have Buddha nature. You have Buddha nature. How could you think of yourself that way?" And I would never want to deify Asian culture, but I think that question of who do we think we are fundamentally, underneath everything we experience day to day, what do we think we'll find? And is it Buddha nature? Is it a capacity for learning and growing and loving, or is it something else? And so my favorite part of that whole exchange actually happened after it was over. We were taking a tea break, and some of the Dalai Lama's Western translators gathered around him, and they began saying things to him like, "Your Holiness, when we read in the teaching something like, give up all self-cherishing, stop self-cherishing, this is what we hear." And, you know, it was just a fascinating cultural conversation.
Now, explain that a little bit more about give up self-cherishing. I'm not quite sure what you're pointing to there.
I mean, I think in the in the teachings, particularly in translations of Tibetan texts, when they talk about give up self-cherishing, they mean give up self-preoccupation, obsession with oneself, develop some interest in others, in the situation of others, develop some compassion for others. But what Westerners often hear is don't care about yourself at all. And, you know, we miss the part where the motivation behind an action is such a crucial element of an action. And so people might hear a teaching like that and think, I'm going to give away everything. I'm going to give away everything I have, not out of this sense of oneness with everyone, but out of this feeling, I don't deserve to have anything. You know, I shouldn't have anything. I shouldn't own anything. I don't deserve to be happy. And I'm just going to give everything away. And you know, classically, I mean, that wouldn't even be considered generosity, because it's coming from such a pained and strange place. But it's very hard to understand that. It's almost assumed in the teachings that we're coming from a place of some self-respect and almost celebration of that capacity to have love and compassion and connection and understanding. And we're not coming from that assumption. So I almost feel like as Westerners, often we have to take a step back and build a different kind of foundation.
Now, you're pointing here to our cultural conditioning as well as potentially personal conditioning, things that happened in our early life. But speak a little bit more to the cultural roots of this self-blame, self-condemnation that many of us experience. What's going on here in Western culture that this is so prevalent in your view?
Well, I imagine, you know, what, even if one doesn't come from a religious background per se, you know, that it's a kind of, it's some question of the reification of the self, separation or alienation from the truth of change. And that ties into the idea of forgiveness or beginning again and guilt. And, you know, in Buddhist systems of morality, if you've made a mistake and you've broken a precept, you've violated the harmony of a community, or you've caused suffering for yourself or for someone else, the thing to do is to recognize that, but not decide I'm that terrible person and I always will be. To recognize it, to feel the pain of it, and to use that as a goad toward greater understanding and different behavior. And so they just say, well, you need to take the precept again. You know, and that's a very different feeling tone than kind of spiraling down into this terrible guilt and feeling like I'm a horrible person and I always will be, and I don't have the capacity to change because there is no change. And, you know, there's a kind of almost a solidification in Western culture that I think doesn't serve us. And then, of course, people have varying degrees of personal trauma from their own childhood and their own lives. And so whether we're supported in growing out of that and having a different sense of something intact inside of ourselves or not, you know, will also depend on where we find ourselves.
Now, in starting our conversation by talking about this exchange that you had with the Dalai Lama now a little over two decades ago, what I'm thinking of, and I want to talk about this with you, is how I've had this experience of being with people who have meditated for quite some time, and yet there seems to be, when I get to know them better, still a sense of self-blame, self-judgment, that it seems like even in their meditation practice, this is one of the last frontiers, if you will, of holding on to the self, is the holding on to this unworthy self or bad self. And I'm curious if this whole notion of self-hatred isn't part of an Asian cultural worldview because of this basic acceptance of Buddha nature, like you were describing, if perhaps the practices, the traditional practices that have sprung from Buddhism haven't addressed this Western challenge in the way that it has to be addressed for Westerners.
Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly if I would say that. I think that the introduction of these practices into Western culture, to the degree that this is a cultural conditioning, in some ways, it's if not in its infancy, is certainly in its pioneering stage. And the context and the environment within which one does these practices is very different now, and won't stay exactly the way it is right now. So, for example, very classically in Asia, you're working quite closely with a teacher, with a personal teacher. And so, since we all bring so much of our own patterns into the practice, you're not kind of left to your own devices, you know, to kind of figure that out, like, wow, I'm trying so hard, you need to relax, or whatever. You have a teacher, maybe not always so politely, saying, you know, for God's sake, relax, you know, or take a walk, or, you know, stop meditating, or whatever it might be, or sending you off to do service, or, you know, that sounds like a punishment, like community service doesn't mean that, but, you know, like, go practice generosity, go into the marketplace and see what happens in your mind and heart as you give away stuff, and, you know, don't just sit there, or whatever it might be. And there's also there's a tremendous context. It's maybe one of the reasons why I was so fascinated with the idea of faith. You know, there's this tremendous context for one's practice. So you feel like you are joining this stream of beings of worth who from beginningless time have been doing these kinds of practices, you know. And so it's not just like mechanical and a method and I'm going to get a little less stressed or you know, however we might take it now. So
just to restate my question in a slightly different way, you don't think because this could be a Western problem, we need a specifically Western solution?
I don't know that we need a specifically Western solution. I think we will probably have a Western form of a universal solution, which will have something to do with the closeness that's reflected in a teacher-student relationship, although it may not be in a teacher-student relationship. It will probably have something to do with community and being part of a community where together we're helping one another see through some of these things. And I think it will have something to do with a bigger sense, a more expansive sense of where one's practice fits in, because it isn't just a kind of mechanical method. It's really done in a certain context. And so we'll also have more fun, you know, mm-hmm. as we...
But you're bringing up something really interesting, which is the role of a teacher. And it might not be that somebody who is listening to this has a spiritual teacher that they work with, but there's some function that person, maybe that's a therapist or maybe that's a mentor, some other figure. What is that, and how does that help us heal this chronic self-blame, that relationship?
Well, I think you're exactly right. It may not be a spiritual teacher, but there is somebody who reflects, hopefully there's somebody in our lives who reflects back to us that sense of worth within us. And they believe in us, even when we don't believe in ourselves, perhaps. And this can also be demanding. You know, when I had one teacher, a Burmese meditation teacher named Sayadaw Upandita, who was extremely demanding and intense and fierce, but it translated within me to a sense of, wow, he thinks I can do it. You know, he thinks I can really accomplish something in this retreat, or he thinks I can really go further than I've gone before. And you know, so it didn't feel like harshness to me. It felt, I mean, it was intense, because it wasn't like, wow, I really think you can do it. It was more like, try harder, something like that. But because I trusted him, and because I do believe his motivation was absolutely for me, it wasn't about his own egotistical needs at all. It worked, you know, and so I felt like, oh, I can put my heart into this. I can really try. I can put in more effort than I'm used to putting in at the stage of my practice, and I can see where it takes me. And, you know, so it, I guess it's about inspiration, and the inspiration can manifest in a lot of ways, but it comes from somebody believing in us. And I think whether it is a mentor or even a peer, somebody who looks at us in such a way that they have that kind of conviction about us, they have that kind of faith in us, that's what we absorb, and that's what pushes us on.
Now, you've talked about faith, and you've written a book on faith and created an audio program with Sounds True, also on faith. And it seems that there's something in that for you that creates the right context, if you will, the right whole view of how we might see ourselves differently. And I'm wondering if you can speak to that, especially in the question here of how we might see ourselves as worthy of self-kindness.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the book came out like 10 years ago, something like that. And I can't remember exactly when we did the audio. But the choice of that topic was sort of an odd choice. And a lot of people questioned me at the time. And you know, some people were angry at me because they had an association with the word faith as being the same as being silenced and unable to ask any questions, and a kind of adherence to a belief system, or else you'd be condemned. And other people were kind of amused. A lot of people were mystified. But there was something in me that felt really compelled to explore the topic, and I think it was for exactly that reason. Whether it is a person who's reflecting something back to us, or there is, for some reason, there's an awakening inside of us that we can take a step, that we can try, that we can not be stuck, that we can be different, that life can be different. We all actually count on that. Otherwise, we'd be completely inert and we wouldn't do anything. And so it's a fascinating topic for me.
As you're speaking, one of the things I'm reflecting on is there's another word that I don't think is very popular across the board, which is devotion. And I hear in you a kind of devotion to the great teachers that you've studied with and the people who have believed in you in your life, these great teachers that you've met. And I wonder how that feeling in the heart towards these teachers and figures might be important for people to reflect on, how they might be able to connect to that in some way.
I think it is important because we don't really arrive at a place all alone. We are, in a way, part of this fabric of life. You know, when one of my favorite reflections of all to do whenever I'm with a group of people is to say, okay, just bring to mind anyone who you think might be involved with the fact that you're sitting here in this room right now. You know, who gave you a book or a CD or told you about their meditation practice or read you a poem, you know, and just see who comes to mind. Because what we realize is that it wasn't happenstance, you know, that every moment of our lives is this confluence of connection, that we're all in that room, wherever that is, in that moment because of conversations and relationships and encounters and challenges and all kinds of things. So every moment is really very rich. And I think this also speaks to that habit of self-judgment or self-criticism is also based on a kind of lonely feeling. The way we view ourselves in that habit, in that pattern, is as very cut off, very isolated, and a kind of sneaky way to challenge it, which isn't directly about the judgment or the the criticism is to go underneath that and to challenge the worldview that's also feeding it.
Mm-hmm. Now, Sharon, I'd love to talk a little bit more personally for a moment and understand from you in your own life biography how being kind to yourself has manifested as a challenge and how you've worked with it. And if could you say there were sort of moments of breakthrough and what those might have been?
Well, I think the way I usually describe it also comes from the book Faith, where I say that I tell a story in the book about going to do a retreat, you know, not that many years ago. So, you know, I'd already been to India and all of that, but going to do this retreat that a friend of ours had rented a house on the vineyard, and we all went to do this retreat, and that there was a cartoon in the bedroom that had been set aside for me from the Peanuts comic strip. And in the first frame of the cartoon, Lucy is talking to Charlie Brown, and she says, "Oh, you know, Charlie Brown, what your problem is, the problem with you is that you're you." And in the second frame, poor Charlie Brown looks at her and says, "Well, what in the world can I do about that?" Then in the third and final frame, Lucy says, "I don't pretend to be able to give advice. I merely point out the problem." And somehow, whenever I was walking by the desk, my eye would fall right on that line. The problem with you is that you're you. Because I'd say, I went to India when I was 18. I'd say from the time I was a child to the time I went to India, that Lucy voice was the dominant voice in my life, that you can't really do anything, you don't know what you're doing, it wasn't almost like antipathy. You know, I had such a confused childhood with so many people dying or leaving or so much transition in that way, that I think the predominant reality of my life was that I felt fragmented. I just felt really disconnected and confused, and somewhere in there, that kind of Lucy voice got very strong. And so then I went to India and I began the meditation process, and it was a combination of my relationship with my teachers and the actual method. I think actually serves to kind of weave, not that unwholesome being stuck on yourself way, but a kind of integration of your being to help that feeling of fragmentation. And it also serves to give you a way to deal with that Lucy voice so that it becomes something that's not so, when you recognize it, of course, it's horrifying. Like, oh my God, I'm always down on myself and I'm always doing whatever. But the more I found through the practice that I could actually have some kindness and compassion toward Lucy, in effect, the less important it was that she was there, that she was coming. She wasn't always there, but that she was arriving. And so it was all the steps of, you know, mindfulness and being able to recognize what's actually going on and not freaking out, not thinking, oh my God, I've been meditating for all these years and Lucy's still here. You know, what's wrong? I've got to get rid of her. Yes, Lucy, you're right. You're always right. You know, but it's really being able to have a completely different sense of who I am and what I care about, so that if Lucy chooses to visit, she can visit, you know.
Yeah, I'd be curious. Yeah, go ahead.
You know, one of the methods of mindfulness that we use is to put a mental note, place a mental label on an experience. And so one of my mental labels became, chill out, Lucy. You know, it's like, hi, it's okay. You can go now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I'd be curious, when Lucy appears now in your life, some people might refer to Lucy as their inner critic, and, you know, some people have names or they don't have names. Is that your basic attitude, chill out, or how do you relate to Lucy?
I think that's my ideal attitude, you know, and I think by and large I do. I mean, in the sense that the hardest thing probably for me is when I feel I have made a mistake, you know, especially if I've hurt somebody or I've done something that I don't really consider to have done as well as I should have or could have. You know, and then to have, I can kind of watch my mind start that spiral. But I wouldn't say it's like a huge, unthinkable effort to say, I've been down that path. I don't want to go there. That's not going to serve, you know, and to kind of divert. So, of course, the degree of my suffering is can be measured in the length of time before I can have that more either letting go or kindly attitude toward the guilt and the Lucy kind of voice. And that's, I think that's actually the case, you know, that it doesn't serve us to be afraid of what comes up in our minds, even if what's coming up is that tremendously critical voice. And so the more we deem it an enemy and see it as kind of solid and like, oh no, you're back and you're always there, you're hiding out waiting to jump me when I'm not suspecting things or, you know, really as bad as you seem to think. You know, it doesn't work. And I think we do get skilled. I think partly because of the pain, the incredible pain. It's like I really can measure my suffering in terms of the length of time before I can say, you know, it's not that I have nothing to learn. Maybe, you know, Lucy is also coming with a little message that's kind of good, but she doesn't need to hang around past delivering that message because it's useless to castigate myself endlessly for a situation that I can't perhaps make amends for or shift at this point.
Now, it's interesting because as you're speaking, I'm reminded how in your books on kindness, you often talk about kindness as a skill or mm-hmm. an ability, something we can develop. And I'd be curious to hear you say more about that because I think sometimes people have some idea like, well, I'm not built like that or something, you know, versus, oh, this is like any other skill, I could learn it.
Well, you actually suggested with the book, The Force of Kindness, you suggested the title, which I just love because I think that not only do we not recognize kindness as a skill, which I'll get to in a minute, but I think we tend to think of kindness as a kind of secondary virtue. And if you can't be bold and you can't be wonderful and you can't be brilliant, it's like, okay, be kind, you know. And but it is so much more powerful than that. It really is like a force and it's a skill. It's not that some people have it and other people don't, although certainly some people have had easier lives with more reassurance and a lot more positive feedback, and it may come more readily. But I think it really is a skill because it's a question of training our attention. We don't even know so much of the time what we're feeling, and we don't see what we're doing. And you know, the times that we just get down on ourselves and we think that's a good thing, that's how we learn, that's how we make change, and we don't necessarily see the cost. But the more we can pay attention, the more we do see the cost. And then we develop the skill to reach for change from a different place or give Lucy a cup of tea and send her on her way or whatever it might be. I think it really is a skill.
And then if you had to break it down for the listener, like, okay, it's a skill and it's 1, 2, 3, that kind of thing. What's the core competencies required to start developing this skill?
Know what you're feeling, so that's mindfulness. Be able to step back from what you're feeling so that you have some perspective on things. It's wisdom. And, you know, take a look at it. It's like when I said we don't realize how much something is bringing us down, for example, we might think it's a good thing, like guilt, you know. But if we really look at it, it's just debilitating us. So develop mindfulness, develop perspective or understanding, and then be willing to experiment is the third, because I think we have so many familiar patterns and ruts and we don't necessarily think of having a little adventure in consciousness, like, okay, I'm going to thank three people today, or I'm going to thank myself, or I'm going to notice when I've made a mistake and I'm going to try to come back more gently and start over. Just little things that kind of punctuate our world of habit, but they take intention. You know, they're not going to come just because we think it's a good idea. It's like reading a book or listening to a CD and then saying, I want to try this out. I want to see what it might give me.
Sharon, just one final question, which is, as part of this self-acceptance project series, we're talking to people with varied backgrounds, but we're talking to quite a few Buddhist teachers. Many Buddhist teachers seem to be very interested and have spent a lot of time focused on this question of self-compassion and self-acceptance. And of course, there's this interesting paradox in using the word self. We're accepting our self. And yet in Buddhism, the idea of a solid self is something we inquire into and ask ourselves, is there even a solid self there? So how do you understand that paradox?
Well, I mean, I think there's a nice phrase in Buddhist teaching that's rarely used, I think, in the West, which is called gladdening the mind. And I think the idea, and certainly if you have a view of a graduated path, of a kind of comprehensive path, they say the Buddha started teaching by talking about things like generosity, because if we practice generosity, we'll gladden the mind, we'll have a kind of happiness and buoyancy and a sense of sufficiency, and it actually strengthens our self-respect. And then if we practice morality, we won't be so freaked out all the time, paranoid, you know, what if they find out the terrible thing I did or whatever, and that also gladdens the mind. And anyway, so it's a whole path that leads us to be able to disentangle this great question of who we actually are and look directly at pleasure and suffering and all matter of things. But we don't, for example, look at suffering with the idea that we want to just suffer. That's not the point. It's to discover that which is whole through compassion, even as we're facing suffering, or that which joins us to a greater whole, even as we're facing suffering. And we need all of those other steps along the way. And so I don't think that skipping that step altogether is actually going to work.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. I've been speaking with Sharon Salzberg as part of our series on self-acceptance. Sharon, first of all, thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Sharon, with Sounds True, has published two books, The Force of Kindness, which is a book that also includes a CD with instructions, guided meditations, and a book called The Kindness Handbook, A Practical Companion. She's also created with Sounds True several audio programs, including a program on faith, a reading of the book Faith, also Loving Kindness Meditation, a series of guided instructions to learn to love through insight meditation, and also an audio, Guided Meditations for Love and Wisdom. SoundsTrue.com. Many voices, one journey. Thanks for listening.